hello and welcome to the podcast version of Fast Talkers with me, Jenny Gow, and a fabulous panel for you today. We're talking all sorts of things, including the three things you're most excited about this F1 season, and of course, Daytona, the Rolex 24. So have a listen and thank you so much. Subscribe, feel free. Hello and welcome to a new episode of Fast Talkers as we bring you the best debate that the paddock can't have because, let's face it, no one's allowed in a paddock at the moment, but we'll bring you as close as we can. And this one's a little bit different from usual because we're focusing on Daytona, the 24 hours, the Rolex 24. It seems to have a race with so many names, but it was a cracker whichever way you look at it. So let's start by introducing you to our panel and go stateside. First of all, we will go to Chief NASCAR writer for Racer magazine. She said, just call me a journalist. Never. It's Kelly Crandall. Hi, Kelly. How are you feeling after the 24?
I'm good. I only had to do an overnight stint to help out the team because that's not my primary beat, but definitely got a good taste for it, more than I have in the past. And I think it was the first time I'd actually really focused on all 24 hours. So I'm okay. It was a little rough, but it was enjoyable. It was a very interesting race.
Now, Lee Diffie, NBC Sports. You also covered Daytona. You're also in recovery mode. This was not your first rodeo, though, was it? You've done Daytona 24 before.
Yes, it was my 13th Rolex 24. And I have to say, it was one of, if not the best. Just the race to the end was incredible. So sometimes you can come away from the Rolex 24 kind of doing a bit, you know, like, nah, whatever. That was just, everyone's come away from it buzzing. It was incredible.
And finally, making up our wonderful panel, we will go all the way across to Denmark. And you go, Denmark, what's that got to do with the 24? Well, this becomes obvious when we introduce our guest. It is Jonas Hüttel. Now, he is going to absolutely slate me for my pronunciation, so I'm not even going to bother because he told me not to. What publication do you work for? I'm just going to say you work for EB.
That's the short version, and a Dane would say EB, or he would say, or he or she would say Ekstra Bladet.
I mean, you just basically went blurred.
Yeah, but you know, if you've seen the Swiss chef in the Muppet Show, it's kind of like that, you know?
You said that, not me. Yeah, now, you obviously had an interest in going across to Daytona. What was it?
Well, there's, I spent the last 7 years being Kevin Magnussen's shadow around F1. So when he goes across the pond to start a new chapter of his career, we naturally had to follow. So it was an interesting experience, an eye-opener. I would have wished to have seen Daytona under normal circumstances with the, you know, people everywhere and access, I mean, especially the access, but still there was 30,000 people and a lot of people camping. So biggest sporting event in the US since the pandemic started, they said. So it was very interesting. And we'll get back to that, but obviously that's the reason.
Lee, just say in comparison to other years when you've been, what did it feel like and how did they manage in these weird COVID times?
Well, they did a good job. First of all, IMSA and the Speedway did a really good job of managing it the best way that they could, you know, with temperature checks and the screening and everything like that. The biggest difference is that the massive difference, as Kelly would attest to, with the Daytona 500. So the Daytona 500, you know, the entire place is packed. You don't see that at the Rolex 24 because very few people actually sit in the stands. It's more of a road race within a speedway. So the usual sights and sounds at the Rolex 24, the infield is jam packed. Like you cannot move. There's not one free camping space. The manufacturers have all of their respective corrals and hospitality suites. And I mean, it's a hive, you know, it's packed and it's amazing just to go through, walk through and a visual spectacle. So that was diluted pretty heavily this year. So you didn't get that same buzz. And I have to say, other than the very first day, I wasn't allowed. If you weren't a pit reporter order or you were actively working inside, we weren't allowed inside. So the very first day we were allowed in the paddock and on pit lane for the first day, but from the moment we started commentating, we weren't allowed back inside the speedway for risk of cross-contamination of going in, coming out, going in, coming out. So, you know, I experienced it on a very quiet day, but yeah, that was the main difference. But it didn't take away from the race.
Yeah, the race was amazing. Kelly, there's so many talking points that we could get into. What stood out for you? What is your sort of take homes from the event?
Well, again, you have to remember this is not my primary beat. So for me, a lot of it was just a learning experience. And again, I covered an overnight shift. So I was really plugged in and tuned in from midnight to about 4 a.m. Wow. And I remember the stint there was really just watching. I think at one point Kobayashi for the Ally 48 Action Express team had driven to like an 18 second lead over the Ganassi car. And to me, that was impressive because I'm not used to seeing a guy just drive away by 18 seconds in anything. So to really learn more about him and just how impressive he's been, and apparently had won the previous 2 years with the team that he had been with. So it was stuff like that. And then of course, you know, the NASCAR connection, just watching Jimmy Johnson and how much fun really he was having. I mean, I know he's done the Rolex before, but it seemed like this year was just different. Like he had a different attitude and just seemed to be looser and more fun. And so things like that. And again, I mean, there's a lot of storylines, but you know, I'm not that person I'll leave that to Lee and Jonas to talk about. But for me, it was more of just a learning experience and just really impressive with what that DPI class was doing and those drivers. And again, the Ganassi car, and could they make it? And because they're always strong with, and then, you know, Wayne Taylor Racing apparently in IMSA is apparently what Hendrick Motorsports or Joe Gibbs Racing would be in NASCAR. They just win everything. So that was fun to follow.
It's so nice as a motorsport journalist, actually, to cross disciplines. And as you say, Kelly, I'm lucky enough to do Le Mans, the 24-hour race, once a year, each year. And I don't cover any of the championship, and I don't really do that much, you know, sports car racing anymore. But it's lovely to come to a sport that you know a little bit, but to come at it from a different angle. And I think the take home, Kelly, is slightly different, the experience and what it gives to you, kind of your day job as well. It kind of enthuses you.
Yeah. So one of the things I've tried to do the last couple of years is get out of the NASCAR bubble, because I've been so committed and so focused on my job and my sport, as I call it, and what I'm doing, that when I would watch Formula One or watch IndyCar or watch the Rolex 24, I would watch it, but I wasn't comprehending it. So the last couple of years, I've tried to really spend more time to understand these other series, the drivers, how it works, why it's so exciting. So I feel like I'm getting better with that. And again, the Rolex in this case was just the first time I had done it with IMSA. And it's fun to, as I told my bosses when they asked me to do it, it'll be fun to broaden my horizons and try something new. And especially when it came to actually writing the hour by hour reports, to sit there and realize that it's going to take me, you know, 10 times longer to write something for that, whereas a NASCAR story, I could crank it out in, you know, maybe 5 or 10 minutes of, hey, this is what's happening at hour 12. Where with the Rolex 24, it's like, wait a minute, I don't know the team name. I have to look that up. Let me make sure I'm spelling the drivers correctly. So I enjoyed that. Yes, that aspect of it, of just learning something new, broadening my horizons. And again, I'm trying to do that more across the motorsports board, and even, you know, Supercross now I've started to get into. That's really exciting. So just adding to the resume, I guess, a little bit. And it's fun to learn what is exciting in other areas and what fans and journalists like in other sports and other disciplines.
And Lee, what about for you? You're the expert amongst us. What were the things that were exciting? What made it such a great race? I mean, we were absolutely nailed to the ending of it, of course, but what do you reckon?
Well, I think that the big point of difference that changed the complexion of the race was having a fifth class, introducing a third prototype class in LMP3. And that kind of was the joker card as far as spicing things up, as far as, you know, there was the field was just over 190 drivers, and 59 of them were rookies. So that really spices it up as far as conduct on track, expectations, you know, just, you know, for basically a third of the field, for them not knowing what they were going into, that really changes things up a little bit. So therefore, it increases the likelihood of cautions. You know, we had almost the same amount of cautions in the first 2 hours of the race as the entire previous year. So, you know, that really jumbles things up quite a bit. But then you add to it, you know, guys like Kevin Magnussen coming straight from Formula One into the IMSA WeatherTech Series, huge draw card, you know, and so many former F1 drivers like Kamui Kobayashi. Then you had, you know, 10 active IndyCar drivers in there and Indy 500 winners. And then you have the Jimmy Johnsons of the world, and you have the Chase Elliott, the reigning NASCAR Cup champion. Then you have Daytona 500 winner, Austin Dillon. Just the eclectic blend of drivers is what really made this year. And, you know, that it has that characteristic every year, but not quite to this magnitude. So that's what made it just super.
And Jonas, for you, is your first experience, kind of, is it something we should all put on our bucket list? Was it good? I know you said it's hard to kind of compare it to a genuine year without COVID, but tell us your experiences. What was it like?
But I mean, the racing itself was fantastic. As many people, maybe if a lot of people here only watch F1 and then the occasional Le Mans, there's one very, very important difference that you need to know. And actually, Kevin said that when I met with him outside of the track. That's the reason I went over there. But he said, just be sure to tell people at home that there's one big difference here. And that's, you know, the full caution yellows and how this race will always be very, very exciting, or most years very exciting in the last couple of years, because safety cars don't work the same way as they do at Le Mans. So if you lose 10 laps in the beginning, you can actually make them up over the course of the 24 hours. I mean, the biggest thing for me was definitely how exciting it was the last about 2 hours. There was basically five cars who could win it, even the Mazda. I mean, that was lapped at one point, actually had a shot at it. And with Danny's eyes as well, Lee mentioned other F1 drivers. There was a really great tussle between Alexander Rossi and Kevin Magnussen, which was fantastic. And we all thought that Renger van der Zande was going to win it for Cadillac 01 at the end, until that blow up. So no, that was amazing. And I know I'll be asked by some of the guys from the FIA if they can learn anything from IMSA. And it's just so much more laid back. Just dealing with the teams, and I mean, the amount of information they share to somebody they didn't know, it's just like, that would have taken me years to get that sort of relationship with the team, for them to just hand out driver schedules and planning this and planning that. Just, no, here's a WhatsApp, just text us and we'll give you everything. I was just like, okay, that's different. That's also American sports compared to European sports. But as a journalist, that was fantastic.
Lee, I'm fascinated to know, how does your 24 hours work? Because clearly, you know, the same for me when I do Le Mans, I'm not expected to work all 24 hours plus previews and reviews. So how do you split it up? How do you know what you're going to do? How does it work?
It's as simple as we just get a rotation, like Jonas was saying about the drivers, like what the driver rotation is. And that's, the driver rotation is more flexible really than what ours is. So we have a crew in the announce booth, and then we have a crew on pit road, and we have a crew in like an infield, you know, a makeshift infield studio. And our producers just say, right, you're here, you know. So it's like, Jenny, you're on from there to there. Kelly, you're on from there. Jonas, you're on from there to there. And we just work to a timetable, and then and get sleep whenever you can.
Sleeping is not glamorous when you're covering an endurance race, is it? What's the strangest place you've slept in during endurance? Can I ask this of all of you, Kelly? Let's start. Where did you sleep during the bit that you weren't working? Did you have to sleep at the track?
So I was home. I believe for Racer, the only person who was at Daytona this year was JJ O'Malley. I think it's different in years past. I think Marshall Pruitt probably has been down there before, but I think this year was just JJ. So JJ, again, was our main reporter, I guess you could say, covering the Rolex 24. So the biggest thing we were doing was just helping him make sure he got breaks and didn't have to be there the whole 24 hours. So I think what we were doing was he was there, of course, leading up to the race, and then the first maybe 12 or so hours of the race. And then, you know, I came on again, as I said, at midnight. And I think by that point he left and went to sleep and did whatever it is that he needed to do. And then again, we broke up the shifts leading until I think it was about 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning when he came back to get plugged back in for the run up to the finish. So again, our whole job, myself, fellow writers and our editors, was just kind of being there in support of him and letting him run the show and do what he had to do and making sure he took breaks. So I was at home. I stayed plugged in my little office here. And then, you know, again, watching up to before I started, I was either on the couch or in my office. And then when I was done, I thought I was going to be more tired than I was. So I thought I was going to go right to bed, but I actually stayed up a little bit longer and just went and sat back out on the couch until I think I just fell asleep on the couch at one point and then was back up by like 7. I was like, oh, I want to keep watching, because at that point I was kind of invested in it and I was really enjoying it. So,
Jonas, what about for you? How did it work?
To be honest, the most important thing I had to do, that was Wednesday, and that was a big TV interview with Kevin that we need for other parts of the season or whatever. So we did do sort of a slow live coverage of the race as well, but that allowed me to, I mean, I went back to my Best Western Plus and had like 3 hours of sleep or whatever. But one thing that actually surprised me about Daytona, because there's a lot of resorts and they claim it's the world's most famous beach. I don't know if I agree on that one. But it's a funny old place, because it looks like something that hasn't been painted since the 80s, and it's a little bit worn. But they told me that, you know, this place shifts, whether it's the bikers are in town or where it's NASCAR's in town, spring break or whatever. But I mean, I've been to Miami before, and I've been to Panama City in Florida, but it's a weird place. I mean, love the racetrack. The place itself is kind of weird. I must say that.
Kelly, do you want to come back at him for that?
No, I mean, he's kind of has a point that I love Daytona. I've told many people Daytona is like my second home, just because I have quite a few just personal connections and things that have happened throughout my life and career that makes that place special to me. But he's got a point. I mean, the area around the racetrack is great. They've done a great job building that up, and it's very modern and sleek and fun. But if once you start exploring more towards the beach, I mean, you can get into some, yeah, you can get into some rough places or just not as good looking, and then you go down to the beach and it just depends on which way you want to go. Some, again, are more built up and nice looking, and then there's other ones that are still a little bit, as you said, maybe stuck in the 80s or something. So I can't disagree too much. It's but that's what makes it fun. It is. It's a very interesting place.
I've had a blast in Daytona ever since I started going there almost 20 years ago. The fascinating thing is and Jonas pointed out to it that he was told about, if you know, during bike week, you know, you're going to the same racing venue, albeit, you know, in different race configuration. But for the three marquee events, well, you actually have four with Supercross. So whether it be the Supercross that happens, it's happening next month in March, whether it be the Daytona 200 motorcycle road race, whether it be the Daytona 500 or the Rolex 24. So you got four marquee events and you get four different groups of people and four very different atmospheric feels. And so, but you're going to the same racing venue. So that's what makes Daytona unique, in my opinion.
Now, I'm not going to let you get away with it. Weirdest place you've had to sleep covering a race, Lee. And also, commentators' issues, toilet breaks. Talk to me about that, too.
Well, this year was fantastic. We were in a different location. We actually had a bathroom in the commentary booth.
No way.
So that was pure luxury. That was incredible. Because usually you are sprinting out the door and down the hallway or down a flight of stairs or somewhere during a commercial break and trying to make it back before the commercial breaks over. So that was luxury. That was terrific. Weirdest place I've slept is, well, definitely you can sleep on the commentary booth floor, you know, put your backpack down and use that as a pillow. A rental car at Le Mans. I mean, I remember I drove from the racetrack in Le Mans 1 year back to the hotel, which was at the rail station, at the railroad station, railway station, and got 90 minutes sleep, you know, so you get the sleep wherever you can. But for Daytona specific, the interesting thing is that if you stay near the racetrack, you, like Jonas did, got 3 hours sleep. That's how many hours sleep I got on Saturday night. You, the kind of the drone, the noise of the cars puts you to sleep. And if there's a caution, everything goes quiet. It actually wakes you up because it doesn't feel normal. You know, same as that Le Mans you've experienced. You get that drone of the cars and it's almost bizarrely soothing, you know, and it puts you off to sleep. And when it's not there, you're like, what's wrong? There must be a caution. And you check your phone or what's happening, you know, on the live timing. So, yeah, not too many weird places this year, but there has been over the years.
I think I'm a bit like Kelly when it comes to that because I'm so invested in it that I don't want to miss a second. So, yeah, for Le Mans, I leave the track to try and get some sleep. But I'm buzzing when I get back and it takes me a good 3 hours to actually just go, okay, now just stop. Fall asleep, get 3-4 hours sleep, and then you're back again because you're like, come on, what's happened overnight?
Yeah.
I can understand why spectators love it so much, and I think all of these 24-hour events have really felt the impact of not having the spectators there, because it's part of it, isn't it? It's like a festival atmosphere, Lee, that everybody buys into.
It is and if you compare the two, if you compare Le Mans to Daytona, you know, you have that ebb and flow at Le Mans where you have that massive surge at the beginning of the race and then people kind of filter away and go back to their camper vans or wherever they're going and then they come back for the finish. Whereas Daytona, it's kind of pretty much like you're there and you know, you don't see that mass exodus and return like you do at Le Mans. So, yeah, two very different races. And for the drivers who have done both, they enjoy the differences as well.
Because I've done some F1 races as well this year. This has been the closest thing to normality that I've seen since we were in Melbourne last year. Just because for a lot of people in Europe, when we are in lockdown right now, going to restaurants, that seemed normal outside of the racetrack, you know, normal people. So I don't know what it's like in a normal year, but this was the closest thing I've seen to a normal sporting event in a year, which was fantastic to be a part of.
Just to explain to people watching at home, so obviously Jonas went across to watch the race, has come back. You're now back in Europe.
Yes, I'm back in Europe, and I have to. We quarantine for 10 days, but you can break it with a negative test on day 4. So I will do that shortly. So right now I am at home, but I did enjoy being among race fans and being in restaurants and going to a steakhouse, and actually went out with Kevin and his PA for dinner. And I mean, he's actually quite funny. I might ask the other guys, because he said he had the experience that over there, he's much more the son of Jan Magnussen than he is Kevin Magnussen, the F1 driver. I mean, people did come up to him because of Drive to Survive and everything. And I mean, he's been with Haas, but, I mean, he was amazed how big a name Jan is over there.
I can recall thinking that at one point in time, we probably should talk about Kevin without mentioning Jan, you know, because he's going to get pretty sick of it, you know, before too long. But, you know, what his dad accomplished, you know, and as you know, Jonas, very well, Jan fully acknowledged that he probably got his Formula One opportunity too young. And didn't realize what he had, and then before he knew it, he was bounced out of Formula One. So, you know, what he accomplished over here was phenomenal, and at Le Mans. And we were very sad to see him lose his Corvette ride and no longer be in the IMSA paddock. So, I think, you know, it's been one race of Kevin's first year in the IMSA WeatherTech Series. So, I think as the year goes on and he travels to different venues and meets new people, I think it's really going to soak in, and he will truly comprehend what his dad achieved in the United States, and not just in sports cars, because remember, he started back in the kart days as well. So definitely Jan is still a beloved figure here.
If we just look at the former F1 drivers, they didn't have a bad showing at all in the Rolex 24. And you have to look at Alex Rossi. When you talk about Jan Magnussen being bumped out of F1 too soon, Rossi has left the F1 paddock, of which he only really dipped a small toe into, and had great success. Is he, for all of you, let's start with Lee, Is he someone who maybe should have had more of a chance of F1, or is he actually just, he's found his feet at home in the US and that's where he is better?
I think there was a fleeting moment where he was toying with maybe thinking about going back. And everything happened so fast for him. When he won the 100th running of the Indy 500 in 2016, it was kind of like, what? What did I win? You know, of course I'm exaggerating, but I don't think, you know, he appreciates now more than he did back then when he won that race. And, you know, things like, you know, buying a property in Indianapolis, putting down some roots, you know, making Indy his home, that's when it became real. And boy, like, he's done nothing but flourish since he returned. So it's going to be that age-old conversation and argument about, you know, do you go in Formula One? Do you stay in Formula One and be with a towards the back of the field team? Was he ever going to get a chance with a front-running team? We'll never know. But, you know, since coming home to the US, I mean, he's a constant race winner and front runner in IndyCar. He's won the Indy 500. The fact that he hasn't won the championship yet, it's a bit of a thorn in his side, but he'll do that. He'll be a champion one day. He's won the Rolex 24 at Daytona. He's done the Bathurst 1000 and V8 supercars. He just continues to spread his wings and enjoy that diversity and succeed at it. I mean, he's a phenomenal driver and a phenomenal talent. So, you know, what was the tail end of his F1 story? We'll never know, but I think he's pretty satisfied with where he's at now.
So I don't think F1's going to be the story when it comes to Alexander Rossi, because you listened again to what Lee just mentioned, all this stuff that he's doing and how successful he is now. I feel like, just again, the little bit that I've come to learn about him just watching IndyCar the last couple of years, is I feel like he's going to be one of those talents to where you're going to start talking about everything he has accomplished and what else could he go and do. So he added the Rolex 24. He's an Indy 500 champion. You know, how many more races can he win in IndyCar? Can he get that championship? Is he going to go try anything else? I mean, again, Lee just rattled off a list of things that I didn't even realize that he's already tried his hand at. So I look at Rossi, and I don't even think of F1. I think of what is his legacy and what is his career going to be in IndyCar? And then at the same time, what is he going to go accomplish because he wants to jump in something else? So I think he's building a career and he's building a legacy and a resume of like one of those once in a lifetime generational talents type of thing. And I think maybe people don't realize that right now. What else can he do? And where else does he want to run? Because I think he's one of those drivers that we could probably put in anything and he's going to be successful. And again, with me, with the NASCAR connection, my wheels are already turning of, okay, well, if we can get more IndyCar and NASCAR crossover, maybe he could be one of those that we could try to coerce into getting into a stock car.
It's certainly very different disciplines. Jonas, for you, we've seen so many people not quite make it into F1, but then they do go over to America and have varying successes. Are there people that stand out for you that have managed to cross over even if they didn't make it in Formula One?
I mean, Marcus Ericsson, for instance, is a better driver than a lot of people give him credit for in F1, for sure. In my country, he's known as sort of a Swedish pay driver because he was at a project, but he's a quick guy. He's good. I mean, we need 2-3 more teams in F1. That would be preferable. So a lot of these guys could get a shot. I mean, I was looking at the average pace on the guys in the DPI class and take up, you know, a guy like Scott Dixon. I mean, he's too old for F1 now, I think, but he's never been there. It would be lovely to see what he could have accomplished, for instance. The crossover is not easy. I mean, there's one thing with those lovely Pirelli tires, which means that there's a reason why you just don't take any American and throw him into F1, because it takes so long to get accustomed to those tires. But I do think that crossovers are fantastic. I mean, Sir Stirling Moss is one of the greatest ever, for instance. And why is he? Well, he never was world champion at F1, but he could drive anything. Alonso is trying to do the same. And the more we can see of their kinds, I think is fantastic. But we need more teams and we need to bring less money to go racing, because that's another issue.
F1, how is that doing in America? Lee, I suppose we should start with you, really. Is it Is it breaking through? Is Lewis Hamilton having the effect? Sir Lewis, should I call him now? Is that having an effect on the US market?
My view is a little skewed because, you know, I come from the television side where NBC Sports had Formula One for 5 years, and we put an enormous amount of work into it, into trying to raise the profile of it, grow the sport in the United States by doing shoulder programming, pre-race shows, post-race shows, specials, etc. There is nothing like that in the United States right now. The incumbent TV rights holder doesn't do anything like that. They don't do anything extra. So what is, in my opinion, and I think a lot of people share this here in the US, what has actually grown the sport of Formula One is Drive to Survive. It has reached a whole new demographic. I was talking to a young guy who was a hotel valet last year in Florida. And I just started chatting to him and blah, 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 blah. Because he had Formula One on his phone. I heard, you know, heard the car noise and I went over and chatted to him. He had absolutely no idea who I was, that I was a Formula One commentator, nor should he. That doesn't matter. But I asked him, I said, what got you? He goes, this Drive to Survive. This is unbelievable. I'm hooked. I can't stop watching it. And I've met people of all ages, from all backgrounds. My local guy, Chip, at the UPS store, where I go and get my mail, he's become a Formula One nut because of Drive to Survive. Even when I was calling Formula One, he wouldn't watch it. And we're friends. But the impact of Drive to Survive has been incredible. That's what's growing the sport. It's not Lewis Hamilton, or it's not any TV rights holder at the moment. It's that Netflix series that has done it, because people love to peel back the layers and see, they've seen what's behind the scenes, and a little bit of controversy and a little bit of bad language and personalities of the actual drivers beneath the helmets. And so I think that's what's grown the sport here. I know I don't have any metrics. I can't tell you if more people are watching Formula One than ever did before, but they're certainly watching that Netflix series.
I know that more females are engaging with Formula One because of Drive to Survive. I remember the study that they said something like 30% more women were going to Formula One races because of Drive to Survive, because it became accessible, because people could touch and feel what Formula One was all about. It wasn't just about sport, it was about personality. Jonas, when it comes to you're following Kevin Magnussen, and obviously the whole Gunther Steiner, I mean, it's turned into a massive thing. It's got to be good for Haas.
Well, Haas is going to be one of the interesting ones to follow this year, because I mean, with their lineup, it's going to be controversy and the soap opera and everything. It's going to be great for Drive to Survive. It will be, I know, I've been told that there's some good stuff in the third season coming up from Haas as well. So I cannot reveal too much, but they will be in there. And of course, I mean, with Nikita Mazepin and with Mick Schumacher there, they're going to be interesting to follow. But I mean, let's face it, there wouldn't have been a Haas this year without two pay drivers. And that's a very, very important point to make. I think we are, it's going to be a very, very interesting season, and it will be in Denmark as well. I mean, in Kevin's time since 14, F1 for us has been the second biggest sport after football, European football. It will not be next year, but we still have a high level of interest, and there's still so many talking points for this this season. Plus, as Lee said, same thing, Drive to Survive is building new audiences here. I mean, my brother started watching, my sister-in-law started watching, and they didn't, even when I was in the sport myself.
Hey, haven't we had a laugh yet at the irony of the two non-American drivers for the American Formula One team Haas have ended up driving in America in 2021?
That's actually a question. But I must say there's one thing, and if there's an American audience here as well, a lot of people have misunderstood the whole thing with Haas and having American drivers. That was never the point. Gene did this team. I mean, he has his NASCAR team, so people know who he is in the US, and he was trying to build a brand outside of the US. But I mean, he always got the same questions when we went to Kokoda and Austin. It's just like, it's never been on the agenda. That's all. But their drivers next year, good luck, Gunther. I like Gunther, but he's going to have his hands full, that's for sure.
So with Drive to Survive, I think what it's done for people like myself here in America, it helps better understand Formula One because, again, speaking for me, I had no interest in Formula One because I was the stereotypical person that tuned in and did not want to see the same person winning over and over and over again. I didn't understand it. I didn't understand how the sport, the gap between teams and manufacturers, how it was like that and how anybody could get enjoyment out of that. With Drive to Survive, what it's done is it has peeled back those layers. It better helps understand the breakdown of teams, the breakdown of money, and how even if you are not, even if you know you are not going to be competing for the race win, to help fans, again, help viewers like myself understand that there are so many other teams that are racing for different things that are just as important to them. They might be racing for fourth or fifth in constructor points, and to them, that's massive. So that's where my interest has grown because now I better understand it. So I think Drive to Survive, that Netflix has done a tremendous job in opening up an audience outside of that Formula One bubble. And also bringing up Gene Haas, I think that's another important thing is because I know a lot of people in the NASCAR world, whether it was media or fans, suddenly were interested to see Gene Haas and this quote unquote American team try to go do battle in Formula One. And that drew some eyeballs as well. So I think both of those things have definitely helped, in my opinion. I'm no expert, but I think that both of those things have helped the last couple years. Maybe, again, just open up some eyeballs and tune in on Sunday. And I know my boyfriend and I, it's like clockwork. It's like, okay, it comes on about 8 or 9 o'clock Eastern here in North Carolina. So we're gonna make sure we're up and we're gonna watch. And now we're invested in it.
Kelly, at the beginning of this call, you said to me before we started recording, you're not a morning person, but yet here you are getting up early for Formula One. That's great.
I don't think 8 or 9 is, I think by 8 or 9, you should probably be up, right? Like I feel like I'm kind of giving away how terrible I am, but I'm saying 8 or 9 is early. I should probably be already up by then, but I will say in my defense that NASCAR is a 24/7 job. So sometimes, you know, especially now that things are ramping up with Daytona coverage, that it's a lot of late nights and early mornings. So,
hey, we are a non-judgmental place. You're in a safe space. Do not fear.
And again, I say early because I'm a night owl and I do not go to bed at any probably healthy recommended time that doctors would be pleased to hear that I go to bed at. So that's another problem, that 8 or 9 o'clock to me is like, wait a minute, I feel like I just went to bed. So
hey, Jenny, I want to grab the microphone for a second if I can. I want to turn to Formula One and ask the three of you, what are the three things you're looking forward to the most in this 2021 Formula One season? You go first, Jenny.
Oh, wow. Okay. Crikey. I'm looking forward to, does it have to be within the season or just the season as a whole? Because I'm still looking forward to Lewis Hamilton's contract being signed.
Yes. Yes. True. So that's one.
Okay. That's one. I am fascinated to see how that Mercedes engine is going to go in the back of a McLaren and just how competitive that can be. Because I think that's got the recipe for success written all over it. People criticised me last time out, Lee, for saying that I thought Daniel Ricciardo would get a race win at least. Of course he's going to get a race win in a McLaren powered by Mercedes.
Back to the good old days.
I think so. Final thing. I mean, watching Haas is... It's going to keep you on the edge of your seat, isn't it?
I think so. Jonas, what are your three?
I'm going to have to copy the Haas thing. I've spent 4 years... you know, being a part of the carpet or the wallpaper down there. So that's going to be really, really interesting to see what actually and whether Mazepin takes over that team. I'm not so convinced that Gene will be there for 3-5 years. So that's one thing. Seeing Checo in Red Bull is going to be really interesting to see one of these midfield guys that you know, finally gets a shot at a top team. I think that will be, it might also help Max. Having a wingman, I think he's going to do great there, honestly. So that's going to be interesting. And finally, the whole Aston Martin project, Seb, he needs to convince me that he is as good as we think. I mean, he's a four-time world champion, but the last couple of years, he hasn't been looking that great, to be honest. So following to see him and if he can redeem himself is going to be a big one for me.
Kelly?
So I have the same of a few things. I mean, obviously Haas, but I look at it more as because I'm just fascinated to see how long Gene Haas effectively just throws money at this program without being very successful. I mean, I don't know if that's a rude thing to say, but I don't think that program has gone exactly as he hoped it was going to go. So not only from that perspective, but of course you mentioned, Nikita. I think it just because social media, that's all I hear about on my timeline, at least, is there's a lot of very upset people that he still has a ride. The second thing is kind of broad because I'm going to say personalities, but again, that's just because my education of F1, I'm really becoming interested in just the personalities. Like you mentioned a Daniel Ricciardo, he just seems so much fun. And again, going back to Drive to Survive, to just learn more about the drivers and his personality and the shoey and all that. And I want to see him be successful because I want to see more of his personality. And same thing with Lewis Hamilton. I think just better understanding and appreciating his talent. So I say personalities and just getting to know drivers and, you know, Max Verstappen seems like he's got so much talent, but I'm just waiting for him to like, does he get mad? Like, does he ever, like, I feel like he's just like, he kind of just like keeps it right there. And he's like, not a robot per se, but I'm just waiting for something to come out. So it's kind of a broad answer. And then I think the third thing is, I will say one last thing on personalities because Alonso's back, right? So I want to know, like, Alonso was before my time, but I know who Alonso is. So I'm interested and really excited to hear how F1 covers him now that he's back, because I don't believe he's going to be in a top car, right? So I think it'll be fun to watch that. And then lastly, before I get too long-winded, is I am fascinated by Ferrari, and I'm fascinated by Charles Leclerc because a couple years ago he was presented as like this next big thing type of deal. And then Ferrari kind of just dropped off the map all of a sudden, and I'm trying to understand why. And I've been trying to understand what happened in their performance. So I don't know if those three make sense, but those are the things that stand out when I think about what I've kind of taken away the last couple years in watching.
I'll answer the last one for you. Basically, they cheated. They cheated on their engine.
Okay.
That showed. So. So now they've had a year to rectify, to play by the rules. I mean, they didn't really get caught, but they sort of did. So that's what happened last year. But it's still going to be interesting to see if they can make it back to the front. That's another one for me. For
okay,
sure.
So I didn't say that, but that's what I was told. And I wasn't sure if that was just like a bias from a race fan or if that was a legitimate thing, but that is what someone blatantly said to me, well, they cheated. And I was like, oh, okay. That's why I didn't say that. But that, so again, like that interests me, that as a journalist, it's like, that's fascinating.
But that's the whole point with F1 and F1 rules. If you read, a fantastic book, Adrian Newey, he's a car designer, How to Build a Car, I think it is. And he tells the way that a constructor, when they design a car, they look at the rules not to try to interpret them as they were written, but to find all the gray areas. So basically, that's how you build a fast car. Ferrari just took this too far, basically. Yeah. That's what happened.
Well, again, I'm excited to just continue broadening my horizon. So I'm fascinated now. I'm going to look that book up because I love to read. So I think I would really enjoy that.
It's a fantastic one. I mean, he built the car that, Senna died in, that he's built all the Red Bulls, McLarens. I mean, he's a fantastic personality and he's a car designer.
I'll tell you what, I've got it here. Hang on. Just to prove that. There you go. Just to prove that sometimes we actually do have a book that we read. It's not just all for fuff. There we go. Adrian Newey, How to Build a Car. It's quite a hefty weight. You wouldn't want to pack it in a suitcase, but luckily no one's going on holiday at the moment. No problem. Lee.
I'm I'm really excited, genuinely excited about the blend, the intra-team battles and how the personalities will blend. So if you start at Ferrari, you know, how's Carlos Sainz going to work with Charles Leclerc, and who takes the reins there? You know, naturally you would think Leclerc, but who knows how that dynamic's going to work. The Red Bull one fascinates me immensely because Sergio Perez is not afraid of anybody, and he has been a street fighter, he has been a scrapper, and he has, in my opinion, ostensibly beaten off every one of his teammates. You even remember that one year he had at McLaren with Jensen, you know, that race in, I want to say it was China, you know, where they banged wheels, and Perez is not afraid of anybody. And Max has been used to wherever he's at, and obviously it's been, you know, whether it be at the old Toro Rosso or when he came into Red Bull, you know, that team was made his pretty much straight away. Ricciardo didn't stand a chance. So I don't think Perez plays by those rules. So I don't think that he's going to be intimidated by Verstappen. He may not have a choice on race results, but I think that's going to be fascinating. And then you got the feel-good factor of seeing a Schumacher back in a Formula One car. You know, I think that's where, and to me, it doesn't really matter where it finishes. The fact that Mick is going to be in that car on a Formula One grid, take his first Grand Prix start, is going to be phenomenal. I think that will touch a lot of us more than we know.
What a beautiful way to round up a beautiful program with a beautiful panel. Thank you, guys. It's really been fun. It's been exciting to hear your opinions and to talk Daytona around Formula One. Wherever you go with racing this year, I hope you stay safe and stay well. Normally, I end off the show by asking for opinions, but Lee did so well, I'm not going to bother. So, Lee, thank you very much.
Thanks, guys. See you.
Thanks to Jonas. Thanks to Kelly as well. And we'll see you next time for another Fast Talkers. Until then, bye for now.